Justice Bell, can you hear me?
Yes.
Perfect. All right. As I explained, unfortunately, Justice Bell had to be down in Southern Nevada today, but she's joining us by, there she is, by way of audio video, and will be participating in the case. Are you all ready to proceed?
Yes, thank you.
And do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, 4 minutes, please, Your Honor.
4 minutes? Okay. As you know, the light will come on and tell you when we get to that four-minute mark. If you kind of plow past that, you're on your own. We just let you know, okay?
Thank you, yeah.
All right, and you can proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Charles Finlayson, and I represent the appellants in this matter, the Natapu family. We're respectfully requesting that this court reverse the judgment and remand for a new trial. Opposing counsel, Your Honors, may it please the court. For more than 50 years, this court has held that when a company makes a defective product, the company is responsible for any product, for any injuries the product causes. This court has explained that the burden is on companies to make safe products, not on individuals to protect themselves from unsafe products. Here, the jury found that the Caterpillar sold a product that was defective because it was unreasonably dangerous. However, the district court committed two main errors, which did exactly what this court said it should not do: direct the jury to disregard Nevada law and focus on the victim's failure to protect himself rather than Caterpillar's responsibility to make safe products. First, the district court erroneously denied plaintiff's motion, which sought to exclude evidence regarding contributory negligence. And second, the district court erroneously denied plaintiff's motion, which sought to exclude prejudicial conclusions in a Mine Health Safety Administration report.
Counsel, as to your first error, were those objections properly preserved for appeal? It seems that some of the arguments that you're making are really a sufficiency of the evidence argument, that they didn't provide enough evidence to prove the assumption of the risk defense. Is that really a sufficiency of the evidence type argument? And if so, was that properly preserved?
So we're not arguing that raising a claim of insufficiency of evidence. What we're arguing is that the district court should have excluded the evidence that we raised in our motion in limine because it was more prejudicial than probative and it wasn't relevant to any of the issues in the case. So in Harley-Davidson, it's a very similar fact pattern. There, the plaintiff was driving a motorcycle while intoxicated and he crashed into a parked car and he filed a motion in limine seeking to exclude evidence of his intoxication. The district court denied the motion, and on appeal, this court said that the district court erred denying the motion because the evidence there wasn't relevant to anything, and it was more prejudicial than probative. So we have the same issue here. We sought to exclude evidence regarding his failure to take the various safety steps outlined in both of our briefing, as well as his prior disciplinary records. We argued that it was only relevant to contributory negligence, which isn't a defense under Nevada law.
But doesn't it also go to assumption of the risk? It's a subjective standard, and you have to kind of figure out what the decedent knew at the time that he exited the loader without all of the precautions. Wouldn't that evidence go to show what he maybe subjectively knew at that time?
No, Your Honor. None of the evidence that we sought to exclude demonstrated that he knew that this loader was defective, which is what you have to show under Nevada law, as well as almost every state in the country.
Well, how else would they show that? Because he's unfortunately deceased. Wouldn't they have to show by circumstantial evidence what he knew at the time, including what the safety manuals have said? I know they didn't allow the prior disciplinary history, but they did allow for an instruction that said this would be an event that would cause termination, meaning not following the safety protocols. Doesn't that all go to show what his subjective understanding was at the time of the incident?
So what this court and other courts have stated is that you need to do more than show that a product is dangerous or that it operates in a way that could cause somebody harm. You have to show that the person knows the product is defective. So what that means here is that he had to know this product didn't have an automatic parking brake. Because if he thought it had it, then everything he did was completely safe. There was a stipulation that this brake would have applied and it would have prevented his death. So if he believes that this thing has that, or he doesn't know that it's missing that, then he hasn't assumed the risk of any injury because he doesn't appreciate any specific defect in this product.
Is that a question of fact for the jury?
Certainly it is, but what this court has explained and other courts as well is that this evidence is really prejudicial and when it goes towards contributory negligence. So courts have to be very careful in admitting it because if it doesn't establish assumption of the risk, it's very, very prejudicial because juries don't want to give relief to somebody if they think they contributed to their own injuries, even if that's not Nevada law. And as I stated, the focus is supposed to be on the company and the defective product that they made. This court has stated that assumption of the risk is not a favored defense. It's a disfavored defense. This court doesn't like to apply it, but it will when you can show that the person essentially relieved the business of any duty that it owed to you because you knew of the specific defect and you continued to use it. So none of the evidence they presented or that we sought to exclude in our motion demonstrated that he knew this product did not have an automatic parking brake. So his prior disciplinary records certainly didn't show that he knew this didn't have an automatic parking brake. And his failure to take the various safety steps arguably shows the opposite, that he thought it was there, because otherwise, why would he have not done any of these steps? So all of the evidence that they presented only shows the very obvious fact that he knew this machine could roll over and kill him, which is true of every vehicle in this mine. Regarding the failure to take the safety steps in particular, the testimony at trial, and which was referenced in the motion in limine, was that people had to do all those things whether it had this technology or not. They were required to do it on all of the machines, and they were trained to do it on all of the machines. So the failure to do that doesn't show that he knew that this particular loader or any of the loaders in the mine did not have an automatic parking brake. And that's exactly what this court has required companies to show. In Mizushima, the issue there was a Centennial telephone. This court specifically stated that the person didn't appreciate the risk of the defect because they didn't know that the defect existed. And this court also specifically adopted Restatement N, which says if the user discovers the defect and continues the product, then they therefore assume the risk of any injury. And then in the Mizushima case that I was talking about, this court gave an example of assumption of the risk, and it said that's when a person, for example, rents a piece of something, and they know it's defective, but they continue using it because the cheaper price on the rental, because of the known defect, is more important to them. So what all these cases show, and what... Yes?
Excuse me. In this case specifically, what facts would you say were admissible and what were not admissible?
So we sought to exclude in our motion his prior disciplinary record and his failure to take the various steps that we outlined, which was chalk the wheels, but that means like putting a block in front of the wheels, turning the vehicle into the side, pressing the parking brake. We did offer, like, if it was relevant, we could make some sort of stipulation on those issues, but we never argued that the evidence was admissible. We sought to exclude it for the same reason as the defendant's intoxication in Harley-Davidson. It's simply too prejudicial, and it distracts the jury because the jury's going to hear that evidence, and they're going to want to find this person to find that he assumed the risk, even if it doesn't actually establish that he assumed the risk.
Did you make those objections at the time of trial when those questions were being asked?
Yes. If you look at our motion in limine, the hearing on the motion in limine, this issue was fully fleshed out for the district court.
But I mean, during the course of the trial when witnesses were on the stand and the answers to these questions were being elicited, did you object at that time during trial?
No, Your Honor. We did not object. Under this court's precedent, if someone raises a motion in limine, and they lose on that motion in limine, if it's fully briefed, fully argued, and the court issues a reasoned decision, then they don't have to continually remaking their objection. That will be sufficient to preserve the objection.
Was there any objection to the admission of the assumption of the risk jury instruction?
They did not. Again, it was for the same reason. The district court had already denied our motion. It already ruled that this evidence was admissible, and it already concluded that it established assumption of the risk, or at least that it was enough to be admissible. So we did not separately object to the jury instruction.
So your position is that your motions in limine, which were fully briefed, argued, and finally decided, was sufficient to preserve all of these issues on appeal?
Again, we're yes. So the answer to the question is yes, but we're not specifically challenging the jury instruction, and we're not specifically challenging the sufficiency of the evidence. We're arguing that the district court should have granted our motion in limine, and without any of that evidence, then we wouldn't have been able to raise those issues later. We weren't really able to because that evidence came in because the district court found that it was admissible and that it went towards assumption of the risk.
How did we get from the district court denying the motion to exclude the assumption of the risk issues to later saying, well, I'm actually going to exclude the disciplinary records, but the other things will still be admissible?
So my understanding of the record is that the district court didn't believe that those established assumption of the risk. And I have that somewhere here in my notes. I'll get it for you when I come back. But he made a comment of it doesn't. Those disciplinary records don't directly go towards assumption of the risk. They were relevant for other reasons, so that's why the district court let them in. But he recognized, the district court judge recognized that they were prejudicial, and so suggested that the parties come up with some sort of stipulation instead. And so that's how that ended up coming in there.
Can you talk a little bit about the admissibility of the Misha report? I just want to get to that before your time goes it gets up. How would you distinguish the I think it's called the Beach aircraft matter in terms of this, you know, whether or not there were legal conclusions, mixed factual and legal conclusions by the Misha reporter, and why that report should have been excluded because of that? In light of Beach aircraft?
So Beach is certainly a persuasive case law this court can look at and rely on. It's a United States Supreme Court case interpreting a really, if not identical, federal statute. But my argument here and our argument in our briefing was that this court generally follows the plain language of statutes, and it should do so here. It should specifically hold that factual findings, facts means the Black's Law dictionary definition, which is something that's objectively true or objectively false. Because otherwise you fall right into this exact situation, which is you end up in a position where parties are able to get in legal conclusions and opinions on issues without giving the opponent a fair chance to really rebut those. And that's exactly what happened in this case. The Mine Health and Safety Administration report was consistently lauded throughout trial as being this organization that certifies everybody. They come in, they do these long investigations, and we didn't have a chance to point out all the errors in that report, or not errors, but issues that weren't entirely clear in that report. We were instead basically left with the jury with the impression that the Mine Health and Safety Administration completely agreed with Caterpillar's side of the case. And I wanted to really quickly respond to something that they raised in their answering brief, because I see my time's going, but I'm going to keep talking here. In their answering brief, that this report just said what everybody knew, which was that he was crushed by the loader. It's actually not true. If you look at the report, what it says was that the cause of his death was the failure to follow company policies and procedures. That is a textbook example of a conclusion that goes beyond a factual finding. It is the opinion of a mine health and safety investigator, but we weren't able to say, well, what about the fact that he'd been using these other loaders, these other mining equipment that had this thing on it? What about the fact that the reason this is on there is to prevent people from failing to do those things because they sometimes forget to? We weren't able to make all those arguments, and instead, they got to essentially have an additional expert report that suggested that an unbiased federal agency agreed with all their positions. It was just fundamentally prejudicial. And this court stated that in Lee and Frias. It was a different circumstance regarding a different instruction. But what this court said...
How do you harmonize Beach with Frias, which is still good law in Nevada, that would exclude the opinion part of the report?
So Frias was on a different statute, or at least didn't discuss the statute. But even if you get past Beach, what Beach said was simply, the statute makes this non-hearsay. Beach specifically says, but the regular rules of evidence still apply. Right. And the regular rules of evidence are substantially more prejudicial than probative. And that leads you right back to Frias and right back to Lee, where the court said it is fundamentally unfair to allow one side to present a government report that contains conclusions about the cause of an accident for exactly this reason. It kind of gives the stamp of approval on the case, and that's something that the concurring justice and Lee argued pretty forcefully. So,
but the report didn't speak to misuse or assumption of the risk. Are those two legal concepts that were at play?
No. What it did do is it spoke to causation, and it specifically made comments that kind of bled into assumption of the risk, because it said, again, not that the cause of his death was that the machine crushed him, which was objectively true. It was that the cause of his death was his own failure to follow company policies and procedures. So that's, by definition, a substantially prejudicial issue that goes beyond, it bled into the assumption of the risk question, even if it didn't directly address it. And again, that instruction merge causation and assumption of the risk. So that issue was fundamentally prejudicial. And they didn't contest, by the way, that if this court agrees that this report shouldn't have come in, that the result of trial would have been the same. So that issue is, I think everyone agrees that this report, if this court agrees, that it was should not have come in, that the result should be reversal.
All right, and we're going to add a minute and a half to your rebuttal. Oh,
thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Questions, and we'll give Mr. Polzenberg a minute and a half added to his time as well.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Dan Pulsenberg for the respondent, Caterpillar. Let's take these two issues in the order Charlie does them. There we go. So, on the issue of assumption of risk, I don't think it's anywhere near preserved. And I don't like to argue preservation of errors. I always say it's the first refuge of respondents. But here, it was definitely the evolution of the case happened in a particular way. So they made a motion in limine, and they didn't want assumption of the risk to go to the jury. And that was essentially a sufficiency of the evidence. Now, at one point in their reply brief, they talk about the paucity of the evidence. Now, I'm from Philadelphia. I don't know a lot of big words. But paucity and sufficiency are either the same or opposites. So they came in and they said, and Justice Bell, what did they ask to exclude? That's a really good question. Because when they argued the motion in limine, they stipulated that he didn't do the five things he had to do to secure the vehicle. So they weren't asking to exclude any of that. So the facts were going to come in that he didn't do the things he was trained to do. Now, they say that they argued to exclude the disciplinary history. That's not true. They didn't argue that at that time. Judge Breslow considered the disciplinary history in deciding whether to allow assumption of the risk to go to the jury. And they wanted to decide pre-trial to exclude assumption of the risk.
Let me ask you this. Is your preservation position based on the fact that it was just a motion in limine?
No.
Subsequent objections?
No. No. That wasn't really it. What it is they were making an argument as a motion in limine, too late to make a dispositive motion. But they moved to exclude evidence, but then stipulated the evidence comes in. They moved to exclude instructions and argument. And twice, if you look at the record, the transcript of the motions in limine, Judge Breslow said, all right, this evidence can come in for assumption of the risk. It cannot come in for contributory negligence. And we will consider sufficiency of that evidence for assumption of the risk when we do jury instructions.
So, Mr. Pulsenberg, I'm struggling a little bit with the order that says, it uses the term alleged misuse and failure to follow safety protocols and somehow separates that from evidence of comparative fault. Where is the line there? Because those two things seem to be the same to me.
Assumption of the risk and comparative fault are not the same. And Judge Breslow recognized that, and this court has repeatedly recognized that.
So from an evidence perspective, what is it? Because the order seems to suggest it's just precluding argument, not any particular piece of evidence. And it seems like there's some qualitative evidentiary difference between those two things.
I was there for the motions in limine, and I cannot ascertain either then or from reading the record what evidence it is they were trying to exclude at the time. I think they just wanted the judge to say that that wasn't assumption of the risk. And he said the jury can consider it for it's coming in to see if they make out a case of assumption of the risk. But it cannot come in for comparative negligence. So when we got to jury instructions, they didn't move for JMAL 50A. They didn't object to the jury instruction. They proposed the jury instruction that we used. And so there really wasn't, but the judge did say, look, you can't argue comparative negligence. And the jury understood they couldn't consider comparative negligence. It had to be the three-factor test that they proposed for assumption of the risk. It's that the decedent knew of the danger and the risk, that he proceeded voluntarily facing that danger, and that that assumption was unreasonable.
Well, is it that he knew of the danger or knew of the defect?
No, he doesn't have to know of the defect. He has to know of the particular risk or danger. They cite a couple of cases, including Childers from Pennsylvania, where there the court said, well, you have to know of the defect in that case to know what the risk was. They do a great block quote where they say he didn't chock the tires and he didn't set certain things. But there the risk was different. There the plaintiff's decedent was standing on the operator's platform and the vehicle lurched and he fell.
Well, so...
So he didn't...
Walk me through this. I mean, yeah. The general idea of it's dangerous to leave a large piece of machinery in an unparked, still on, and unparked and unbraked is just a general idea of, you know, if I get out of this thing, it could keep rolling. Versus the design defect is it didn't have an automatic brake, I get out of it, it's going to keep rolling.
But two things. He knows it doesn't have an automatic brake. He is trained... On this loader,
that's going to be a separate question. But in this particular case, in light of what the danger is being alleged, don't you have to know the defect?
No, you don't. You have to know the subjective risk. You have to subjectively know the risk. So in Childers, not everybody knew that if the things weren't set, the vehicle would lurch and could knock you off. And there was no proof that the decedent in that case knew about that. Here, am I making a general argument? Look, everybody knows, and Judge Bezos and I ventured off into parking cars into San Francisco. Does it have to be a generalized knowledge? It has to be a subjective knowledge. So if he had a generalized knowledge, that would be enough. But I don't have to go there here, because I have proof of a subjective knowledge that he knew about this particular risk and danger, that the vehicle could roll. And he'd been trained on it repeatedly at the time the judge decided whether he was going to preclude assumption of the risk. He considered the disciplinary history. He could consider that. So that wasn't excluded until...
You alluded a moment ago to he knew that this loader did not have an automatic brake. What evidence was there that he knew that it didn't have an automatic brake?
That he was trained on this vehicle, used this vehicle in the past, and that the training included that it didn't have an automatic brake. It's rare, although there are some vehicles that have, or some Caterpillar machines that have automatic brakes. At the time, it was rare, and it was rare with Newmont. It's an option that Newmont could have bought. But there are a lot of reasons, and the trial is full of that, a lot of reasons why a mining company would not buy an automatic brake. So he's trained in it. He subjectively knows of the risk. And that's what gets us into assumption of the risk. It's different from comparative negligence. In the Childers case, the court said, well, maybe, even though he was never told about this particular thing that would happen, maybe he used it before and saw it before, but that's not enough for assumption of the risk. That would be constructive knowledge. That would be comparative negligence. So here we have actual knowledge.
Mr. Poldenberg, can I turn your attention to the admissibility of the Misha report?
Yes.
Because we do have case law such as Lee versus Baker, Frias Valley, and there's extra jurisdictional case law such as Sullivan and Guerra, all of which excluded reports that spoke to the ultimate conclusion in the case from a legal standpoint. And the report does say that the cause of the injury was the decedent's failure to follow safety protocols. So why is that something that should be acceptable in terms of admissibility?
Let me do an answer backwards and address your last part first. It didn't say the cause, it said the root cause. It wasn't an opinion on a ultimate issue in this case. The issues in this case is, was there a defect? And was there assumption of the risk? You know, I remember when this court used to say there were five factors in negligence: duty, breach, cause in fact, and proximate cause and damages. So here what we're looking at is root cause, a factual cause. Was this a cause? They make fun of us in the reply brief what we said in the answering brief. What the MSHA, it's MSHA like OSHA, what the MSHA report said was, yes, his failure to follow these five steps on which he was trained was the root cause. They objected, saying, well, that doesn't, the report doesn't go to defect. It doesn't go to defect. Judge Breslow said, I'll give you an instruction when we argue the motion in limine. I'll give you an instruction that none of this goes to defect. And he did give an instruction that none of this goes to defect. And guess what? The jury found defect. So this didn't interfere with that. It also doesn't interfere with assumption of the risk. Because MSHA did not make a determination that his failure, we know he failed to do things. In the motions in limine, they stipulated that he failed to take those
five steps.
Well,
that goes to the point of the probative nature of the report. If they were willing to concede that he didn't follow the safety protocols, what was the purpose of the report? Wasn't it just to suggest to the jury that it should just reach the same conclusion as the agency, which they may have lauded as kind of an expert, given that it's a governmental actor, and they had no opportunity to cross-examine or examine the report writer because of federal laws precluding that type of testimony.
Well, now you sound like Justice Gordon Thompson concurring in Lee versus Baker. But those cases, Lee versus Baker and Frias versus Vail, go to police reports. I am not arguing that police reports come in as evidence. And 50.
But Mr. Fulkenberg, isn't this really the same problem, right? Like, because the problem with police reports is
they're pretty bad.
Of hearsay, the conclusions that police officers make about, say, who was at fault in an accident, how is this different?
Oh, it's very different. This court in Frias called the investigation cursory, in Lee versus Barker called the report confusing. This is a well thought out, well done investigation. And Judge Breslow went on at length about weighing, you know, they say we got to do the four.
You concede that the report did not account for or consider whether there was a design defect.
Right.
Correct?
Right.
So how does a report speak to an issue in the case? The case is about an allegation of a design defect.
Well, and it also can't be reversible error where the jury did find a design defect.
But I mean, you're introducing an opinion in the report, and we can
as to the facts of what happened.
Opinion, factual opinion, but right. An opinion in the report that the cause of the accident was this gentleman's failures to follow certain things, even though the report doesn't consider whether there was a design defect and therefore how that would have impacted what the cause of the accident was. So how does the opinion part of the report speak to the issue in the case such that it was proper to admit it, or
well,
was it more prejudicial than probative?
Two things. I think you're rather making my point that it doesn't go to the ultimate issue of defect. And the judge told the jury it didn't go to defect.
Yeah, but we understand that the judge makes the admonition to the jury, but you've put in front of the jury, you know, a presumably, you know, objective, impartial government agency saying that this was the cause of the accident.
Was the root cause, and it was.
Not just factual findings, but this was the cause of the accident.
Well, that is a factual finding, and that's what the Supreme Court was talking about in Rainey, Ashcraft Aircraft. I'm not allowed to ask rhetorical questions, but what could possibly be the harm if it's coming in to say the facts that everybody already knows the facts are? This vehicle did roll, this machine did roll because of the failure to take those five steps.
Then what's the probative value then of that report if everybody understands and agrees that Mr. Natapu, actually failed to follow the safety protocols. Everyone agrees that that was the case. So what was the purpose of, what's the probative value?
It does go to the facts of the case. So is it hearsay? No. It's exempted under 51.155 as being hearsay. It doesn't suffer, that statute also says you have to consider the trustworthiness. And Judge Breslow did and looked at the good job that the agency did in putting together the report. What are the facts they found? The facts they found are honestly not horribly in dispute. He failed to take those five steps. Does it have probative value? Yes. Is it cumulative of the other evidence? I've never seen this court reverse on cumulative.
But is it more prejudicial because it
can't be prejudicial because it doesn't go to an ultimate issue.
Causation is not an ultimate issue.
It's root cause, Judge. It's a factual cause. It is not defect, and defect caused the injuries. It is not assumption of the risk. It's going to, Your Honor.
That's an opinion about, I mean, that's their ultimate conclusion about the cause, which is kind of what the jury's job is, right?
I think the jury looks at facts and applies the law to the facts. And so the facts they would have to consider is it a defect? Is it assumption of the risk? And here the jury found defect, even found misuse. So you can't say they were misled by this report. The report stated facts. The U.S. Supreme Court in Rainey talked about how a conclusion drawn from facts can be a factual conclusion if it's not a legal conclusion. A legal conclusion are mixed issues of law and fact. Thank you, Your Honor.
Perfectly timed, Mr. Pulsifer.
You should have been here in the old days, Judge. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Finlayson.
Thank you. Okay, so on the page 735 of the record, the conclusion section, there's first the root cause analysis section, which says, as Mr. Rosenberg stated, that the cause of the accident, I'm not quite sure the distinction between the root cause and the cause. Certainly the jury wasn't given that distinction, and that's part of the problem. The jury was not given these nuanced distinctions. They had a report that said the cause of the accident was Mr. Natapu's failure to do those steps. It's the failure to do those steps and the failure to follow company policies. Again, in the conclusion section, it states it again. The accident occurred because company policies, procedures, and controls were not followed. Well, that is a disputed issue because our argument was that the accident occurred because there wasn't an automatic parking brake. And that was the cause of the accident. And if you actually look to the briefing on this issue, they even conceded it at that point in the briefing. With this whole idea of like the jury's job, this court has already answered that question. There's no need to overrule those cases. In Frias, this court stated, is the function of the trier of fact to decide who and what caused an accident. In Lee, this court stated, the concurring justice, the issue directly related to ultimate issues in the case, negligence and proximate cause, which was the instruction given in this case, by the way, of necessity it contained the conclusions of its author who was not subject to cross or any examination. It was referred to in jury argument as the official record of Mineral County. So in both of those cases, the court identified the exact same problem as the report in this case. And then in Dubois versus Grant, the court stated, we conclude that the district court did not err in sustaining objections to questions which called for Grant to give a legal conclusion about the cause of the accident. So that is the issue in this case. This report directly told the jury that the cause of the accident was his own failure to follow policy, with the government's seal of approval, which this court has already recognized is substantially more prejudicial than probative. Even if you adopt the United States Supreme Court reasoning in Beach specifically says that does not mean the regular rules of evidence are out the window. And this court stated in Harris that all evidence is subject to the balancing test of probative value versus prejudice and NRS 48.035. And by the way, in Harris, the court did say that in balancing the probative value and the prejudice, when there was no dispute about the underlying evidence in that case, which was gruesome photographs, then the evidence had no real probative value, but it had a high potential for prejudice. So when there is other evidence that establishes the same point, which is what Mr. Polsberg said, the probative value of that evidence goes down. That's what this court stated in Harris.
Was there other evidence presented at trial regarding the factual things that happened in terms of the injury?
Yes, we had experts on our side that said the cause of the accident was the failure to have an automatic parking brake. They had an expert on their side, which said it was his failure to follow company policies and procedures. And then they got this report in there as well, which essentially gave, you know, put the government's thumb on this, that side of their scale. The jury was not given the opportunity to meaningfully weigh these different issues. And yes, it didn't say that the product, that they did a defect analysis. We were able to get that instruction, by the way, over his very strong objection. But it did not address the fact that it didn't go towards assumption of the risk, and it didn't, and there was no instruction that said you're to consider this for only the limited purpose of establishing the factual cause, which again was not in dispute, the factual cause that he was crushed by a loader.
I have one more question.
Yes.
How do you respond to Mr. Polzenberg's statements about whether it was required that, how do I pronounce the gentleman's last name? I apologize.
Natapu.
Natapu.
Thank you.
Whether Mr. Natapu knew about the danger or knew about the defect.
This
court, central telephone, our case just talks about knowing about the danger caused by the defect.
It says at one point, I believe that's the case regarding the couch, it says the person couldn't have known the danger caused by the defect because they didn't know the couch was defective. This court stated that in the other case I mentioned earlier, which is escaping me right now, and then again in Mizushima, the example this court gave was a person who knows of the defect and continues to use the product. That's what the restatement says. And almost every single court, I think they identified one court that drew some sort of more narrow distinction, but almost every single court says you have to understand that the product has a defect and know what that defect is in order to appreciate the danger. Because as you pointed out, if he does not know that this product does, this loader doesn't have an automatic parking brake, then he's not appreciating danger because when he gets off the seat, he thinks it's going to go on if he thinks it has this. And just to briefly, I know I'm out of time, but the issue of that he did know it, that was not raised at any point in any of the, I believe he says it for the first time on, and there's an appellate brief with no citation. If you go back and look at the argument in the motion of limiting hearing, he specifically said, I don't have to make that showing. And again, they were required to do all of those things on every product, whether it had the automatic parking brake or whether it didn't have the automatic parking brake. And many vehicles at this mine in all over the world have this technology on there. And the one that Mr. Natapu was using earlier that day had this technology on there.
That raises another question.
Yes.
I apologize. But is that, and I apologize if I've missed it somewhere, but is that in the record that there were other vehicles at this mine that had the automatic brake?
Yes, and I have it somewhere. If you want me to step back, I can definitely grab it.
Loaders in particular or just other vehicles in general by Caterpillar?
Other vehicles. My understanding is that this generation of loader did not have it. The prior one did, and the next one did, if I remember the record correctly. This particular, the 2009 didn't, for whatever reason. Our argument was that it was because to lower the price because its competitor did have it, and so it was able to lower the price by removing that feature. That was our argument during trial.
All right, got to stop you there.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.